I'll just very briefly introduce Tantek by saying I can't believe we actually managed to get him to Australia. I mean, this could be the busiest person I've ever met, and I'm pretty busy, but, you know, he makes me feel like a sloth. If you're on, I've got his chat, and we chat sometimes, and any time of the day or night I connect, Tantek's there, right? So you think, oh, he's just got it on. And you say, hi, Tantek. A couple of minutes later, invariably, he comes on, right? So I imagine he might have been catching up on some sleep there when he was a little bit late. But anyway, so look, he's been fabulous so far. He's going to talk about a tremendous thing, a little bit geeky, but a lot of it's the idea. If you can get the idea of what he's about to talk about. So if you're not a code person or you're a little bit iffy about the code, don't worry about the code. Get the idea. Because if you can get the idea of what he's talking about, then that's what really this is all about. The code side, the technical side, isn't all that hard. So can we welcome for the final time, Tantek Celik. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Everyone had some good coffee or tea during the break? Let's see. There we go. All right. So assuming the podcast has started, so once again, I'll announce for our listeners that this the entire hypertext of this presentation and the podcast is under a Creative Commons Attribution by 2.0 license. So before we get started talking about microformats and evolving the web, I want to give you one quick update. On semantic tables, Roger Hudson was kind enough to come up to me afterwards and point out that there was this great article that he'd written that in my copious busy time I hadn't managed to notice. So there it is. I strongly recommend you check it out. It's got some great examples, visual examples of additional complex semantic tables, like 3- and 4-dimensional tables, where it becomes really essential to use headers and ID and all that to be able to tie together what cell is related to what other header content, et cetera. All right, enough about that. I'm going to talk a little bit about, let's see, is this working? Great. Well, let's try it out. There we go. I'm going to talk a little bit about archives. And this is sort of not that related to microformats, but it touches on some related subjects that I think sort of affect all of us. And some of the principles that come out of this actually do affect microformats. So I want to ask a quick question. How old are people's email archives around here? Like, how many people here keep email archives that are, say, 2 years old or more? Okay, how about 5 years old or more? How about 10 years old or more? Okay, how about 20 years old or more? I'm looking. Okay, so this is actually a pretty challenging problem. If you've ever, like, moved your email, you know, from machine to machine, like, how many times have you moved your email archives? I mean, I'm going to guess that I probably moved mine, I don't know. I've lost count. So how many people think they've moved their email archives to me like 10 times? Yeah, that's quite a bit. 5 times? Right. And how many different email programs have you used across those switches? Okay. So, you know, this is a serious problem. Like, what, when you move your data around, what format do you keep it in? It's one of those things that, you know, you import, you export, and inevitably something gets lost. One email program keeps track of whether you reply to an email or not, another email program doesn't, or they do so in incompatible ways. Okay. And then what apps do you use to browse these archives? I know that if I took my 20 years worth of email and dropped into any of today's email programs, it would just grind to a halt. I mean, that would be, it would basically be like playing the Rainbow Cursor channel. And that's not very satisfying. So what do you use to browse these archives, right? And then to search them, right? I'm not going to put all my private email on the web, you know. I mean, yes, you know, Google may be doing no evil, but still I'd like to not trust them with all my private email. Call me paranoid, but... And what about things like photos? So this one particularly I take personally because I lost a lot of photos in a hard disk crash that, you know, should have had it all backed up, but thought I had, but apparently hadn't. In 2002, and it's interesting because the photos that I was able to recover were the ones that I had posted on my website, but this is becoming more and more of a problem. So let me just ask, how many years worth of photos do people have archived? How about 1 year? 2 years, 5 years of photos, okay, or more, obviously. 10 years of photos, digital photos.
Digitized.
Sure, digital or digitized. Wow, that's impressive. So I've pretty much filled my hard disk with the photos I'm taking in my camera, and I'm not sure where to put them anymore. So this problem isn't going away. And not only that, but you know, JPEG works pretty well today, right? Does anyone have photos saved in a format that's not JPEG? Yeah. So let me see. Is it some sort of RAW format that the camera gives you? Right. And how much confidence do you have that RAW format will be readable in 10 years? Yeah. This is a serious, serious issue. And it's one of these problems that like vexes me both from like a UI standpoint, from a technology standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, from like a historian standpoint. Like we're generating all this data, and if it's something that's going to disappear in 10 years, it's like cultural legacy is being lost. So, let me just ask this: what are the oldest data archives that you have, like of any sort of electronic, source code or pictures or anything? So some people had 20 years worth of email. I saw that. So let's start at 20 years. How many people have 20 years or more of some sort of archive of something? Okay, we got a few. How about 30? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. So, you've probably moved that across about a dozen or so different computers, different platforms, different operating systems. How about disks? Anybody have 3.5 floppies that they keep things on? How about 5.25-inch floppies? How about SCSI drives? Anybody have SCSI drives with data still on it? And how confident are you that in 10 years you'll be able to get the data off? Yeah. What file formats are these all being kept in? This is a massive challenge. Like when you upgrade computers, you've got to move all your data. And if you cross-grade or whatever, switch one direction or the other, or the third direction, perhaps. What do you do with that? What transfers and what doesn't? I've found that I can transfer my email, my photos, my text files, my HTML, but my mail preferences? How about email rules? How many people have successfully transferred email rules from one mail program to another? Really?
One.
Which programs?
From Mail to Entourage.
Sweet. So that's like a Microsoft product, huh? All right. There you go. Any other programs? Yeah. This is the kind of thing. There's we're generating all this data, preferences or whatever, that you put mail rules, right? How many hours have people put into mail rules? And yet, if you have to transfer that from machine to machine or from to another program, it's probably lost. So there's some amount of stuff that gets left behind. And then there's the nightmare scenario. What happens when your computer breaks and you have to recover your data? This is or one of your web services breaks. Anyone remember desktop.com? Do you guys remember this? It's like, store all your data here on the web because everything is net accessible and you'll be able to pull it down anytime. Poof, they disappeared literally. Like the site went down overnight and there was no chance of retrieving your data. It's one of these things where startups were crashing left and right. So, we've sort of gained confidence in this new generation of startups storing our data. Companies like Flickr. Now, Flickr is probably going to be around since Yahoo bought them, right? But there's tons of other little startups that are gathering our data all the time that we're trusting. And what confidence do we have that they're not going to just disappear tomorrow? What are you going to lose forever? Let's see. Those batteries must be low on this thing. Ah, hard drive crash. I already mentioned that. Has anyone here ever recovered fragments of a file from a hard drive crash? Okay. Now, how many of those were text files? Or text-based files, like HTML counts as a text file. How many of those were non-text files, binary files? So you guys record portions of a binary file. That's impressive. So my experience has been that if it's been a text file, a text-based file, I was able to recover all kinds of bits and pieces. But if it wasn't, like if it was a binary file, even a photo, I was pretty much out of luck, or an application. Because as soon as one or two sectors or whatever were corrupted or lost, that's it. It was gone. Today. So this brings up a question of, like, what's recoverable and what isn't? So when you're designing data formats, one of the sort of interesting things to think about is the data that you're storing, and is it something that, say you lost a chunk of it, does that make the whole rest of the file useless? Or does that mean that you just lost that one little piece? Now, we kind of take things for granted, like with HTML and with text files today, that, like, oh, yeah, if I just lost, you know, a portion of an HTML file, I'd lose a few paragraphs or whatever. The rest of it would be right there, no problem. But you'd be surprised at how many different binary file formats there are that you're probably using today, where if you lost, like, say, the first chunk of the file, or even the last chunk of the file, the entire file becomes useless. And this is far more common than you might think. So why do we care about this? We're archiving, moving, and recovering data all the time. All the time. I mean, effectively, across everyone who's using computers, somebody is archiving data, recovering it, moving it right now. So just to be clear, microformats are not going to solve all those. All right? This is a massive problem, but it's important to think about, like, why is this important? And my hope is that by understanding some of the problems with archiving and moving data, and just considering about that, you know, everyone back up, right, when they get home. I carry one of these with me, USB keychains. How many people have a USB keychain type device? Yeah. And how many of you actually, like, use that for backups? Yeah. This is a lesson that I learned the hard way, too. Even when I started getting into the habit of backing things up, I would go on a trip, and then my hard drive would crash or something. And then it's like, whoops, all my backups are at home. What do I do? Well, if you've got a USB keychain, you know, you just back things up regularly, and that just sort of solves that one more problem. But there's principles at work here. Like I was talking about, the data formats that, you know, if you lose the first part of the file or the last part of the file, losing the whole file, you don't want to design formats like that. You want to design formats that if you lost a piece of it, the rest of it should still be usable. So that's just my imploring all of you to think about that. Now, we've heard a lot about Web 2.0 at this conference, and I must say that my personal opinion of Web 2.0 is I'm actually kind of mixed about the buzz, the hype. There's quite a few amazing technologies sort of coming out within the last, you know, year or so that, or being rediscovered, such as XML HTTP, aka AJAX, right? There's real technologies there, and there's real power, and there's real innovation. But there's also an incredible amount of hype. And I worry sometimes, you know, does the hype exceed what it can actually do? So I'm going to give you a couple of themes of my own that I think are central to Web 2.0. The first is you control your own data. So in the past, there's been other major sort of revolutions. You might say open source has been such a revolution with the theme of you control your own destiny. You know, if you use open source, you can always you can always modify it and change it however you need to keep evolving it. You're not dependent on a specific vendor to keep maintaining it for you. So I think that one of the things of Web 2.0 is you control your own data. And by that, I'm saying users, as a implementer technologist, I take the maxim that users should own their own data. And so whenever I'm designing systems, I try to make sure that users can take out whatever they put in. This is essential to one of the other central themes of Web 2.0, which is mixing and matching services and data. So in order to do that, you really need some form of open data format to be able to exchange things between services, data formats, and protocols as well. So a lot of the Web 2.0 applications are built using REST, right? We're talking about this protocol just based on simple HTTP requests. So I'm going to talk about more about the open data formats piece. So what this means, users are free to move their data away from broken interfaces, programs, and sites now, and into better ones. Why would any company support that? Right? Almost every company is thinking, I want to hold on to my users. Why would I want to let them take our data away? Right? It's crazy. So why are people doing it? They're doing it for a lot of reasons. Some folks are actually doing it because they're doing the right thing. Right? Once in a while, you hit a developer that's working on a program, maybe even a browser, that says, hey, this is an open data format. It's the right thing to do to support it. Another big issue is trust. So as things like the whole desktop.com debacle, losing people's data, other services like feeling trapped have happened to more and more people, more and more users have realized, oh my gosh, I don't want to be stuck with whatever, you know, vendor I chose, or maybe I didn't choose the vendor, maybe my office chose the vendor, right? for open data formats, there's more and more better source, better tools, better tests. And so it's oftentimes cheaper for an implementer, a technology company, to say support an open format rather than develop their own format. Now, this isn't really widely known, or I'd say, or sort of like, what should I say, widely internalized. But it's more and more true to the point where I think more and more companies are doing that. It's much easier to import. There's much more data to import out there if you support an open format rather than come up with your own. And network effects. This is a really big one. If you go and ask Yahoo, why did you guys support RSS? Yahoo is this great system that once you've entered a whole bunch of data in there, it's like it takes care of you. All these, your mail program, all these things are really nicely integrated. And your feeds and all that now. But they actually support RSS, letting people publish, letting people both aggregate into Yahoo and subscribe to Yahoo feeds into other services. And you wonder, well, this is a huge company. They had control of everything. Why did they do this? And one of the big reasons is network effects. With open standards, no matter, especially open data formats, no matter how big you are, I mean, you can be Microsoft. It doesn't matter. You benefit by supporting open standards because of all the other folks supporting them. And the more people support them, it goes up exponentially. The other thing is, this is a race. So in evolution, there's this problem called the Red Queen problem. How many people are familiar with that? So I really like biological analogies because I think they apply a lot to other aspects of life. And the Red Queen problem is essentially that what happens in evolutionary arms races between, say, bacteria and their hosts, or between different species trying to occupy the same niche, is that they literally have to evolve just to be able to stay in their current population, just to be able to stand still. So this comes from a chapter in, I think it's Through the Looking Glass, where Alice is running with the Red Queen, and they're both running as fast as they can, and they're not going anywhere. And Alice asks the Red Queen, why are we running when we don't get anywhere? And the Red Queen says, you have to run just to stay in the same place. So with Web 2.0 coming out and all these different startups coming out and developing things quickly, you have to support open standards to ramp your user base, to ramp all those to leverage those network effects, to import all the data that's already out there faster than anyone else. If you don't, you're going to be left behind. All right, so what do open data formats enable? So this is something that's really frustrated me by a lot of programs. If you use a lot of software, you get stuck with whatever interface just decisions that the designers of that software made, or even websites. The same problem occurs. As soon as you use an open data format, you can now both the designer can evolve those interfaces independently from the data, whether it's a web-based user interface or an application on your computer. And the users can also switch between them as well. So you get this much more rapid co-evolutionary effects. So what are the key requirements of open data formats? It has to be highly interoperable. How many people know how many internet RFCs there are out there? Anyone know, approximately? I think that's about right. Yeah, we're not up to 4,000 yet. So how many of those are actually deployed? Maybe 10%? Maybe 1%? Right. So if you don't actually have, it doesn't matter if your format is totally open. If it doesn't interoperate with stuff that's already out there, or if people don't build anything on top of it, it doesn't really matter. Another big thing that I think a lot of folks don't pay attention to is they develop these formats for the web, but they're not particularly web-friendly. You're thinking, what are they thinking? There's a lot of formats that are developed that people basically say, well, if I just develop the format, then all the tools and everything will change, all the publishers will change, and everyone will be happy. I'm not going to name particular names, but I think you probably could find a few. And when I say open, I mean truly open data formats. So a lot of formats, they're open as in like, oh, look, you can read them. Like it's XML, therefore it must be open. Well, open means a lot more things than that. It means that the patent issues around it are resolved, hopefully royalty-free. It means that there aren't any sort of other weird IP restrictions around them. It means that it's defined somewhere. And I would even assert that in today's world, if you don't have a specification for the format freely available on the web, your format is not truly open. All right, a little bit of history here. All right, so enough about Web 2.0. Let's go back to Web 1.0 or 0.0 or whatever it was. All right, 2000, 2001. Reliable CSS finally shipped. Web designers are transitioning to CSS slowly, carefully, but they're doing it more and more. Because for the first time, you can actually ditch fonts and tables completely if you can actually code just the modern browsers and replace with the CSS equivalents. And the first CSS hacks appear. So I have to sort of clear something up here. A lot of you probably sort of heard my name with regards to the box model hack, and you probably don't know the full story behind that. Because I actually didn't think it was that big a deal. I mean, it's like a little bit of code just in CSS, you know, IE5.5. You know, I wasn't using IE5.5 Windows. How many people were at the time? Apparently a lot. And how many people have to code for IE5.5 or 5.0 Windows still today? Yeah. So that, obviously, I was completely clueless. And this was in 2000. I didn't even, 2000, 2001. I think it was 2001. So, but fortunately, I had the ear or the email of a good friend that knew this stuff, Jeffrey Zeldman. And he basically we were going back and forth. I'm like, you can do everything with CSS. You don't need tables anymore, right? You guys have all heard this before. But I was saying that back then. And he's like, no, you have to use tables if you want to support IE5 Windows, IE5.5 Windows. I'm like, why? What's the problem? He's like, well, if you want your pixels to line up, which some clients do, right, then you have to use tables to get precision layouts. I'm like, wow, that really sucks. And I'm like, okay. So he explained the problem to me with the box model being different and all that. And I'm like, okay. He's like, well, if there was some way that I could send a different style sheet or different style rules or widths or heights to IE5.5 and 5.0 Windows rather than IE6, then I could use CSS. And I was like, really? That's it? I'm like, okay, that should be easy. And he kind of looked at me. Actually, he didn't look at me because it was over email, but he kind of responded. He kind of looked at me like, what are you talking about? This is easy. And I'm like, well, this is a trivial thing. Just give me a sec. So literally, like, I spent a few minutes like looking through the CSS1 test suite, which there's a lot of really interesting hidden gems in there. If you're ever sort of curious to look through a test suite, which is one of the more sleep-inducing things you can do. And there's one particular page that tests errors in CSS. It tests illegal CSS and tests error recovery. And I knew that IE6 Windows had done a great job at completely passing, that page. They completely passed section 7.1 of CSS1. So, but I knew that IE5.0 and 5.5 had problems. So I went there and I said, okay, well, why don't I just find something that screws up IE5.0 and 5.5 but doesn't script IE6 on this page? It was literally that simple. So I found this weird case of like, oh, look at that. They don't support escaped quotes. And so after a few more minutes of hacking and all that, I came up with this hack, sent it to Jeffrey, and he's like, oh my God, you've done it. So from that point on, he's like, okay, now we can actually do this. And I think, I'm not positive, but I think that might have been used in the List Apart 2.0 design. I'm not positive. Somebody else with more history might... 0.5? It might have been, yeah. Yeah, I think maybe 2.0 we used the add import hack to filter out Netscape 4 or something like that. Anyway, CSS hacks. Enough about that. I just want you to let you know that it's all Jeffrey's fault. Okay, so what happened with lots of CSS1 support? There's more CSS, less HTML. Documents got smaller. I mean, we all know this stuff, right? XHTML use increased greatly. And then we started to see in 2000, 2003... some more interesting changes coming about. So like anytime any area matures, you find new things you have to fix up. And so Wired News redesign, by Doug Bowman, was a huge, huge step forward there. It really demonstrated, a lot of people know that CSS was here, was real, and like, oh my gosh, a real news agency is actually using style sheets across their entire site. In many ways, as people have noted, this and the CSS Zen Garden, I would say, which happened, I think that was in 2003, was a real tipping point for CSS. It was all of a sudden not only doable, it was obvious how many beautiful things you can do with CSS. So people also started doing more things than more semantically. Now, right now, we take headers and paragraphs for granted, but that certainly wasn't the case back then. And so this is a really obvious example. I just call them bed and breakfast because, BMBR, right? This is strict HTML4, right? This is not transitional, but it's still totally abusive markup. And you know, that's what you should be doing over there with the headers and the paragraphs. And of course, the advantages of that are that, guess what? Search engines find your headers and go, you know what? That's a header. I'm going to treat that with more significance than just a bold tag. And the other thing is, you want to style your paragraphs? How are you going to style this text over here? You're not. Not by itself. And so this idea of using tags as separators is basically something that we've abandoned for the most part, and just using tags as containers. Another example. How many of you use A-names to mark points in a document? You have to.
Yeah, there's support issues.
Who said you have to?
There's support issues. Not all current popular browsers support the A-track ID.
Which one?
Give me an hour, I'll speak to you after.
Netscape 4.
Okay.
Everything else since Netscape 4 fully supports ID. So if you still have to support Netscape 4 fragment identifiers, that specific case, you have to use A-names. But this is no longer the case for the most part. I mean, how many people here don't have to support Netscape 4 in their work? Or how many people do? I should ask the opposite question. Okay, there's still a few. So you guys, A-names, if you need to make that work. Otherwise, that's what you should be doing. The other thing is that blogging tools arrived around the same time and really started to take off. And because they were sort of like the new kids on the block, the blogging tools were adopting semantic XHTML at a far more rapid rate than anything else. And so things like rel equals bookmark were adopted to show permalinks. And people all of a sudden rediscovered that, oh my gosh, there's this rel attribute. So then 2003, I was sitting in a session at South by Southwest, and I think, was I sitting with you, Eric? Was this afterwards?
You were sitting with Matt.
I was sitting with Matt, okay.
Oh,
very good. So I was sitting at South by Southwest, and there's this presentation about web blogs. It's like, oh, and in the future, you'll all be social networked through these, you know, through these faux files. I'm like, what the heck is that? Okay, so I went and looked it up, and it's like this huge RDF thing. So I'm not going to talk too much about that. But suffice it to say, I'm like, this is really ridiculous, because I looked at what people were already doing with blogs and blog roles, and like there already was an implicit social network. It was called a blog role. You were already linking to people as pages. So I said, well, why not just add a rel attribute and... You know, why don't we just add a rel attribute to say what your relationship to the person is? So got together, long story short, asked that question in a big wide audience, met up with Matt Mullenweg and Eric Meyer, and we said, hey, let's do this. We launched it. It took us like 9 months or something. Why did it take us so long?
Because we had real jobs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was just for fun. Right. How many people actually blog professionally? Wow, okay. Good job. Good work if you can get it, right? The amazing thing for us was like we just did this for fun amongst sort of our crowd of friends. We're like, all right, why don't we just launch it out there and see what happens? Within weeks, there were authoring tools. Blogging tools have been updated. There were plugins. There were browsing tools. There were editing tools. The open source editor, NVU, supports it. There were search engines introduced weeks later after that, and we'll show some of those. We also introduced XMDP, XHTML metadata profiles, to actually have a formal way of defining our XHTML extensions, like XFN. So in 2004, a whole bunch of things happened. So a big one was the O'Reilly eTech conference. Myself and Kevin Marks had taken the idea of extending the rel attribute and said, well, there's a few more other things you can do. We'd also come up with this thing called Shosho, XOXO, because I think we were in a chat room in IRC. It's like, how many things start like that, right? I'm in a chat room in IRC. Somebody mentions OPML, and I'm like, what's that? So he says, oh, it's an outline markup language. I'm like, wait a minute. I know HTML, and HTML's got lists. What does OPML do that HTML doesn't? And we're like, I don't know. So I spent some time and looked at it, and was like, there was never any reason for OPML to ever exist. You could do it all with ordered lists. So that's what Shosho is, literally. Eric, Matt, and I put together a poster of XFN. We said, hey, you know what? We did this for fun, but why don't we submit to the academic community and see what they think? And so we did. Sort of on a lark, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was actually accepted. So the ACM Hypertext conference, we actually had a poster on XFN, and we're like, well, okay. It's been adopted by implementers. It's the academic community thinks it's at least worthy of discussion to put up at a conference. That's pretty cool. In the fall of 2004, there were a bunch of other discussions around an event called Food Camp around how do we do vCard or iCalendar on the web? How do we do it? And so we came up with a bunch of concepts to essentially just reuse them, but do it in XHTML. And I'll give you more details on that later. And we also documented the principles we came up with for microformats. So 2005, this has been literally an explosion of microformats efforts. You know, why don't I ask, before you came to this conference or read the schedule, how many people had heard of microformats? Yeah, that's quite a bit. And that's one of the reasons is this year it's been pretty out of control. RailTag, we designed and developed because obviously this whole tagging thing started to take off, right? People using Delicious and Flickr tag their links and tag their content, tag their pictures. We're like, well, why don't we let people tag their blog posts right on their own blogs? Well, how do we do that? Well, we have to point to space. We have to point to a tag. Anyway, long story short, we came up with a simple standard for this. We proposed a standard for the community. The community was like, hey, this sounds good. We implemented it in Technorati to index these tags pages, and the response was remarkable. So let me just see if I can show you. This is a video made by some students at Carnegie Mellon. Okay. I can't do fit to screen or something? All right. Can I maximize it? Does that work? All right, good enough. So this is a video that some students at Carnegie Mellon made that we said, hey, they asked for our tag data. We're like, okay. So literally, they asked for our tag data from the first tag that Technorati ever indexed, the first rel tag. And so we took that, we sent it all to them and said, all right, here's all tag data we've indexed for like 6 months. Have fun. And they came back and showed us this video, which really sort of shows the kind of adoption that tags had. Do we have audio on this thing?